Welcome to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast by Scott L. Wyatt, president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. To subscribe to this podcast, please visit www.suu.edu/presidentspodcast, where you will find both the audio and a written transcript for today's podcast. Hi again, everyone, and welcome to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast featuring Scott L. Wyatt, the president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. I'm your host, Steve Meredith, and I'm joined in studio again today, as I always am, by President Wyatt. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Steve.
It's good to see you again. And this is part of an ongoing series of podcasts about innovation and some of the barriers and some people that we admire who are doing interesting things that we want to talk to as we look to be more innovative and forward-thinking in what we're doing. And today we have a very interesting guest who was one of the keynote speakers at the recent annual meeting of the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities annual convention up in Seattle. And as you know, in my job here, I worry about what NWCCU thinks about us. And I was very impressed by what our guest had to say and also some of the struggles that he had with accreditation bodies generally and just competency-based learning, I think, is one of the things that we're going to be talking about. So will you introduce him?
Yeah, it's my pleasure to welcome Scott Pulsifer, who is the president of Western Governors University. Welcome, Scott.
Welcome. Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate being with you.
We probably ought to start with a little introduction about Western Governors. And I've often thought that Western Governors University was born in Cedar City, even though that may be a small stretch.
But and there is some truth to that, as you know. We have a great heritage, beginning with Governor Mike Leavitt, who was very much a part of WGU's founding, and he is one of the favorite sons from Cedar City, Utah, and also a Southern Utah University graduate.
And he used to be our board of trustee chair.
Yeah, well, there you go. That I didn't even know that either. Myself being new to higher education as well as new to the state of Utah. So I'm always learning something new, but I do know Mike's influence is broad and deep.
Yeah, so give us just a little sketch of WGU.
Yeah, happy to. So WGU itself, as somewhat as the name also implies, its heritage. It was actually 21 years ago, was established or founded by the governors of 19 Western states and territories, and Governor Leavitt of Utah, as well as Governor Romer and others, were huge sponsors of conceiving ways by which they could dramatically expand access to high-quality education for underserved populations. And these populations existed in all of their respective states, and they knew that they needed to find new pathways for increasing the competency and skill and capability of their respective populations to meet the needs of their growing economies and their growing workforces, and that they knew that the future of work was going to be defined by, you know, capabilities that were going to stretch the existing capacity, if you will, at the time of their what I would call maybe their kind of middle workforce, if you will. And so in conceiving this notion of a new model of an institution, they knew probably a couple of things. First and foremost, they knew that the education itself had to align closely with what workforce needs. And that was the idea, even behind that, was the idea of competency. You know, what are the competencies that are required for success in the respective areas of the workforce? And how do you design curriculum and education to map to those competencies? The second thing they knew is that the internet and the advent of and really the acceleration of the the digital age and the third industrial revolution is that the internet was going to be a powerful force in reinventing a lot of different things. Surely everyone knows how it's reinvented retail, but I think there was a clear sense and vision that the internet would also dramatically expand access and allow higher education and the institutions that provide it to reach and teach students where they are and to allow them to learn independent of time and place. And so those two kind of hallmarks became the foundational elements of Western Governors University. And so that was 21 years ago. That is the namesake. And now, you know, fast forward to today, what started then is now one of the largest institutions of higher education in the country. We have over 110,000 full-time enrolled students in bachelor's and master's programs in all 50 states, and over 7,000 enrolled students here in Utah alone, and probably over 8,000 or 9,000 graduates of WGU in the state of Utah, and where we have over 125,000 graduate alumni across the nation.
It's gone a long ways in the last 21 years, hasn't it?
It very much has, and I think if you even asked Governor Leavitt or any of the other founding governors, I think it's far exceeded any expectations they had for it when they conceived it.
You have kind of a unique student body in that, if I understand it right, Scott, you've about three quarters of your students are full-time mid-career people.
It is true. About 70% of our students are working full time. The biggest single indicator of the student body that we serve primarily is that they are individuals who have some prior college but have not completed a degree or a credential. And these individuals span all age groups. They also span multiple different workforce sectors. But it is true that about 70% of them are working full time. About the similar percent probably have children. But most importantly, we recognize as part of WGU's founding that even today, over 70% of our students are in one or more categories of underserved population, be that low income, rural, military, ethnic minorities, first generation students, et cetera. And so, That is the target, really, of adults that we have intended to serve in our design.
And since you're serving that, since you have that many students that are in that category, that really kind of naturally leads you to competency-based education, doesn't it?
I think so. I wouldn't, to be fair, I don't think I necessarily draw the distinction between competency-based and the adults or the students that we serve. I think it has more to do with designing learning outcomes to map to opportunity. And so one of the kind of core aspects of our design around competency-based is that you first and foremost have to ensure that the curriculum, meaning the learning objectives and the learning outcomes of the courses and the programs in which students enroll, that the learning outcomes of those have to map to the skills and needs and skills, capabilities, and competencies that are necessary for success in the workplace. And that education-employment alignment is one of the key things that we began with in designing our curriculum model. When we thought about the design of that, what we knew is that the competency-based approach would be very clear, absolutely clear about the learning objectives. And when we think about the learning itself, the competency-based model says, the mastery of those learning outcomes or the demonstration of proficiency, if you will, is what matters most, not the time to demonstrate that proficiency. So we knew that these individuals, and in reality, all individuals, I think, learn this way, is that we will focus and spend our time, energy, and effort to learn the things that are more challenging for us, and we'll accelerate through the things that we already know. In both cases, you have to maintain a high bar and standard for proficiency. But the competency-based approach says when you demonstrate that proficiency, we know that you have demonstrated the capabilities necessary for success and employment. And so when you complete that and demonstrate proficiency, you can move. I mean, you can complete the course and move to the next course. There's no time-based component with it.
Yeah, I don't know how we got into this Carnegie model that was time-based, that a semester is... For one credit, a semester is 15 hours in class, regardless of...
That's right. And I think the history of the Carnegie unit is not hard to figure out. It worked really well for paying faculty. meaning how many credit hours were you teaching as a faculty member, and so they could determine that that was how much you should be paid for teaching. And then I think it over time kind of evolved into, well, a 1 hour of class time should require 2 hours of study time. And then to be a full-time student, how many credit hours do you have to be enrolled in, and how many of those credit hours have to occur over how many weeks? And sure enough, you evolve into what we today have is that credit hour term-based model that is the conventional system of things. And so WGU, as you and your listeners are learning, when you remove all of that, it starts to create a bit of confusion among those who are very used to supporting a credit hour-based model, whether that be regulators, accreditors, faculty, institutions, you name it. When all of a sudden you design something differently, you have to rethink the whole model.
Yeah, in some ways, so we've partnered with a technical college here in Cedar City, and they're almost exclusively competency-based. If you're studying to be a welder, nobody cares if you got an A or a B or a C in the class. They just care if you can pass the competency test at the end of each segment.
Yeah, that's right. That is the design, is that you keep the learning constant, as we like to say, and you let the time vary, because the proficiency against those competencies is what really matters. And even the grades, not that competency-based is perfect, but even in a graded credit hour model, those grades aren't perfect either, because a C could mean, or a B even could mean, that you're really deep in one area but shallow in others, but the aggregate score is a B. Or it could also mean that you're shallow in all areas and deep in none, and that also gets you to a B. And our argument is that if you're clear about the learning outcomes, and then you have really effective ways by which you assess proficiency against those outcomes, then if you meet the standard, which we believe is at a B average or better, meaning you have to demonstrate proficiency across the full scope of learning outcomes, then you are complete and you have demonstrated mastery, and then you can progress to the next course. Not surprisingly, what you may find at WGU is that those pursuing bachelor's degrees at WGU, on average, will complete in 2 years and 4 months.
On average?
On average, yeah. And so very different than a traditional, 4-year degree, right, where, it's in theory 120 credit hours to complete a bachelor's degree, and you should do that at 15 credit hours per term over 8 terms or 4 years. Like, well, that's fine. I think that's a good measure of how much effort should go into completing that. But in some cases, if you can master and demonstrate proficiency quicker, you can accelerate to that which you can, and then spend the focus time on the areas where you need to study more and study more to ultimately achieve proficiency. And so that flexibility of time does allow a model that, if you will, fits into a working adult's life more effectively than more of the traditional campus or residence or classroom-based models.
The fact that students can move through it more quickly, do you find that to be motivating for them?
Surely, I think we do, especially if you take an individual who has had acquired learning but through non-academic setting, meaning they may be working in software development, or they could be working in a medical and health profession, they could be working in accounting and bookkeeping, whatever it is, and they're able to very effectively leverage their prior learning and accelerate and complete quickly. And ultimately, that also has the benefit in WGU's model, where we have a fixed tuition per 6-month term, but within that 6 months, an individual can complete as many courses as they're able. So it is possible for our students to not only see success in progressing their learning, but if they can accelerate, they can reduce the total cost of their bachelor's degree or master's degree as well, because you can complete in fewer terms a fixed cost per term. There's no per credit hour cost. So,
so one of the really interesting pieces of this competency-based model that you've got, and I'm curious to get your take on it, because some of the students, as you've acknowledged, are able to take their life experiences and bring it in and move through more rapidly. So to some degree, education is seen as being the providers. Higher ed is seen as being the providers of the educational experience. But in some respects, competency-based education is a combination of providing education and also simply evaluating the education already achieved and putting a stamp of approval on it. So to what extent is competency-based education assessing learning that's already occurred versus teaching beyond what the student already knows?
There are, in reality, I think competency-based can cover the continuum, if you will, meaning that one thing is for certain, there are multiple sources of education that are available to students, to adults today that weren't available before. And if you think of, even pre-internet era, that a large portion of the value of universities was that it truly was the harbinger of so much of the knowledge that needed to be transferred from institutions to individuals, or from professor to student. And that existed in the context of textbooks, lectures, seminar series, experiential learning projects, you name it. But in many ways, the internet has dramatically compounded the availability of that information and knowledge, and has also compounded the access to that knowledge. Now, I don't think anyone would be wrong in assuming that much of the learning also occurs in experience, meaning as much as you can gain from lectures and books and everything else, once you start having to apply that which you're learning in theory or in textbooks, etc., to a working environment, you're actually dramatically expanding your learning and the efficacy of it as well. And so a competency-based model, it really just adjusts to where the individual is, regardless of how you may be acquiring the learning. And that's true even if you've never done the job before or never practiced it in some other environment. So even if you've had no prior learning, you can still accelerate. If there's certain things, I surely did this even my freshman year. I came out of high school, and I think every individual has probably experienced this. Even though I'm a BYU alumni, even though I went to a traditional institution, there were surely certain classes I realized that the lectures didn't add significant value for me, or I didn't need to spend as much time in a lab or in a study group because I had either had the prior experience in learning through courses that I took in high school that were college prep courses, or it was just subject matter that was more that naturally was a strong learning category for me. I think in a competency-based approach, it just adapts to an individual's capabilities in a way that a credit hour model is more fixed. And so regardless of whether you've already come with just inherent aptitude for learning a topic, or you have prior experience doing it, or you've had prior learning, that competency allows you to accelerate and that competency to be assessed. Lastly, I'll say is there are surely prior learning assessment or direct assessment models that institutions leverage out there as well. That is not WGU's model. WGU's model is you do have to enroll in the course, you have to progress through that course and complete the assessments. In a prior learning assessment or direct assessment model, institutions specifically allow individuals to go through an assessment before they ever enroll in a course. So they kind of test out of taking the course. We don't have that model, but that is a form of competency-based.
Competency-based has been around longer than Western Governors, of course.
Oh, yeah.
The area that's the most clear in my memory is that 30 years ago, 35 years ago. When was it, Steve, when I was that young?
I don't know.
I just remember when everybody came home from serving in foreign countries for a couple years. If they'd been to a country where they had to learn a language, they'd come back home and go down to Brigham Young University, take a test, and immediately get 12 or 15 or 20
right.
credits, whatever it was.
And right.
In my case, it was 16 credits. Yep.
16.
You effectively got a minor in that language.
That's right.
That's right.
One day minor.
Yeah.
And then they'd transfer that to any other school in Utah. And so that's, is that what you're describing happens at WGU?
That is not. So that's what I would call prior learning assessment or direct assessment. So in my case, my language was Polish. That you could take the foreign service exams and other exams that were specifically assessed all of your, you know, verbal, written, and, you know, under comprehension in that foreign language. And in my case, I realized that the tests themselves were not as far advanced as my own ability in the language was. And so that is a prior learning assessment, meaning that Steve, as you said, it was a one day, you know, minor, because you could take the test and basically prove that you're fully conversant and knowledgeable and competent in that particular area. That is not what WGU does. WGU, you would actually have to enroll in the course and then accelerate at your pace through the course. It is still possible for an individual to complete a course in 2 or 4 weeks, but they still have to progress through the assessments that are part of that design curriculum. So we don't separately have faculty who just, you know, assess prior learning and test out of courses. They enroll in the course, they take the course, they take the assessment, but one student in that course could take 2 to 4 weeks, another one could take 2 to 4 months. But both of them have to demonstrate mastery in the course. Some institutions have that direct assessment or prior learning assessment model like you referenced. WGU is more of a course-based, competency-based model.
Well, and it doesn't cost the student any more at WGU because, as you said, it's a fixed amount for the 6 months.
That's right. It's a time-based tuition, not a credit hour-based tuition or a credit-based tuition. We still do have credits. So our course design, while the pedagogical model is competency-based, we still have courses that comprise the program. So you still have to complete the credits associated with that, but some can complete 15 credits in a term. Others will complete 30 credits in a term, and at the pace at which you go is a function of your ability to accelerate your learning. And I think one of the other things I maybe just would like to add, that one of the strengths really around WGU's model is, as the individuals that we serve, so many of the challenges they may have faced before in stopping out of prior college experience had more to do with what we like to call affective domain or non-cognitive domains of capability. And these have to do with learning how they learn, with communication capabilities, with self-efficacy and purpose. And that what we recognize as a key ingredient to that is our faculty mentor model. That while we have a competency-based pedagogical model, we also have a faculty model that really allows an individual student to have a dedicated faculty mentor that's a specific subject matter expert in their course of study, meaning if you are in a degree for accounting or a degree for nursing or a degree in computer science, that faculty mentor that you have has a master's degree or higher in that field of study, and they are with you from day one until the day you graduate. They're there to provide you all of that integrative instruction that you need, to provide you targeted tutoring where necessary, to connect you with the course faculty necessary, course planning, you know, readiness evaluation, assessment, and evaluation reviews. Like they really are there to mentor you through your program, and that has been a key ingredient to helping our individuals remain dedicated and committed to the learning that happens at a distance, and it's been really effective in achieving the completion and attainment rates that we see at WGU.
I don't know. Steve and I were talking about this, and it seems to us that WGU is the leader in competency-based education on the university level. I don't know anybody that's doing it better than you. Are there other schools that are weighing in on this?
Yeah, I think that's what you say is surely true in terms of just the sheer scale. We do know that there are some reports about 2 years ago highlighted that there were upwards of 500, 600 institutions that had some programs or pilots in place around competency-based learning models, whether that was in a specific course or for a whole degree program. There are few that have the same scale as, or anywhere near the scale of WGU with our 110,000 plus students. But there are surely institutions I would I'd probably point to, even like DePaul, the University of Wisconsin system. There's definitely been some exploration of it with Southern New Hampshire University and others. And I think they've been, you know, I think they're learning for sure. And as you noted earlier, like, we didn't invent competency-based education. We probably have implemented it more effectively than any other prior models and scaled it well with great student success.
But speaking of the scale of this, I've been amazed at, you know, 100,000 students, and you're talking about a one-to-one faculty mentor. We've also talked about the fact that the Carnegie model provided a tidy little framework for paying faculty, or at least assessing the amount of work that they were doing. How do you do that in what seems to our Carnegie-addled minds a chaotic model? How do you keep track of faculty, time?
Well, I think one thing is that we don't actually track faculty time, meaning that all of our faculty are full time, but it's not measured in terms of how much time of that they spend lecturing. One of our key things is that we first and foremost are a teaching institution. We are not at all confused about the primary responsibilities of the faculty. The faculty are there to really support students in their learning and their progress, whether that be at a program level or a course level, whether that be curriculum faculty who design and develop our master curriculum. And so our faculty are focused on teaching, such that the performance is focused on student success and student experience measures, things around progress and persistence and ultimately graduation and satisfaction rates. We focus on those student success measures, and our faculty are full time. So we think about the expectation is that you are working full time, 40 hours a week. The difference is that it's like having 40 hours of office hours a week for a faculty. I mean, there's no scheduled lecture sessions or lecture times, that you are there to support students on an individual one-to-one basis. We do have cohort, and we call them cohorts, but effectively they are like a group instruction session where 20 students simultaneously will sign up for a teaching session, and those surely occur with a lot of our course faculty. But that is a different model. Think of it this way: in an online context, a lecture is just another form of content, meaning you can record it, and then you can play it back when you're available, not when the faculty is lecturing. And so that content in an online context is not necessarily that dissimilar from an online textbook, from study questions, from other learning tools that may exist. And so all that content has to be augmented by the one-to-one engagement instruction that the faculty provide for the students. And so that's the model that we designed the role for the faculty, and all the performance is about student success and attainment.
I had an experience with, a lot of universities have an open, like Open Yale, for example, where they take a class, record it, and just put it online, and then anybody can watch it for free.
Yeah.
And I took one of those classes from Yale. It didn't cost me anything, and it was recorded lectures, and it was spectacular, actually. It was the faculty member from Yale who taught this course that was videoed, and then I got to then watch. It was spectacular. At the end of the last lecture, I wanted to stand up all by myself in the room alone and clap. I was so thrilled with what a great job he'd done.
Well, there's
ahead. One of the things that I noticed or thought was is that my experience was better than the experience of the students that were paying Yale tuition in the classroom.
Yeah.
because I had the syllabus, I had a transcript of all of his lectures, and I had the tapes, and if I wanted to take notes, I could just make an underline on the transcript that I could download, which students in class couldn't download. And if I didn't catch something, I could rewind it and play it again.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've found, as you referenced, is that Scott Galloway is a great example of how the internet and technology is dramatically expanding the access to high-quality learning resources. We had talked about how these, how lectures, when put online, is actually just really rich content that you can access that content independent of the time and place. Meaning now it democratizes the learning resource in a way that it wasn't previously possible. And Scott Galloway is one of the examples who's been one of the real advancers of leveraging the internet to dramatically expand access to his incredibly useful knowledge around marketing in the digital age and evaluating kind of strategies and mechanisms. So this is a good example of how learning resources today and even teaching models are dramatically expanding. Udacity and Coursera, Khan Academy, there are many of these examples of open educational resources that are becoming the models of learning in the future. That we know it actually not only improves the access to the education, but it can also improve the quality of the education. And one thing specifically about WGU is, and this isn't necessarily widely known, is that we do not develop the majority of our learning resources. We, as a primarily teaching institution, in the design of our curriculum, that also includes the sourcing and evaluation and selection of the best third-party learning resources as part of the curriculum that's designed here. So the vast majority, 90%+ of the learning resources utilized at WGU for our students are licensed third-party resources. And in some cases, that even includes the likes of Udacity and Coursera courses into some of our technology programs. It definitely includes textbooks and content from peer institutions and from larger scale providers like Pearson. And that is the one thing that we have as the benefit of being a technology-powered learning environment. We can also evaluate the efficacy of those different learning resources in improving individual student mastery of the competencies designed in the course. So it is a unique model. That is a role that faculty, in a traditional sense, had all that responsibility. They had to not only design the course, write, get the syllabus designed, select the learning resource or write the textbook. They had to write and design the exams, grade the exams, everything else. Our model is such that we have faculty who separately design and develop the curriculum. They also source and evaluate and select the learning resources as part of that curriculum. And then we have separate faculty who teach at a program and course level, and even separate faculty who evaluate students' assessments.
So you've got that divided out, did I hear, in three different categories?
Four actually total. So we actually have curriculum faculty, course faculty, program faculty, and evaluation faculty. The course and program faculty, those are our largest total number of faculty, and they are the primary teaching faculty. So the program faculty are those faculty mentors that we talk about, and the course faculty are the specific subject matter experts at a course level and in a program.
So how do the faculty feel about, or how does, what would you say is the advantage to separating the assessment from the teaching faculty and the curriculum faculty?
One of the biggest benefits is the integrity of a competency-based model, so that those who are designing the curriculum, including the learning objectives that define the competencies to be evaluated, they also design the assessment. Now, separately from that, you have evaluation faculty from the teaching faculty. So those who create the curriculum and design the curriculum are separate from those who teach the curriculum. And so the teaching faculty have a very individual student focus, where the curriculum faculty's job is to ensure the quality and relevancy and the integrity of the curriculum. The teaching faculty are focused on ensuring the student's progress and mastery and attainment and completing courses. But the evaluation faculty do not have any of the subjectivity of the teaching faculty around any individual student. They are unbiased, objective faculty who evaluate students' performance on the assessment and give highly valuable evaluation feedback that then is reviewed with the teaching faculty and the student. And so that integrity, I think overall for us, the design has done two things. One is it allows us, most importantly, to give an individualized faculty experience for every student. Second, it maintains the integrity of a competency-based model. Those who design are separate from those who teach are separate from those who evaluate student performance.
So in some respects, the evaluation faculty serve as auditors for the students and the teaching faculty both.
That's a good way to look at it.
Because they're assessing whether the teaching and learning has occurred.
That's right. And really the goal of the program mentors, that program faculty and the course faculty, are to ensure that every student, regardless of your learning approach and style, regardless of your prior learning in it, regardless of your capacity for it, whatever it is that their job is to make sure that you can advance in your mastery of that, and then having a third-party objective assessment of that. And so we know in this model that every single student who completes a course and a program, that they all were held to the same standards.
That's probably the only way you can do it at the scale you're operating at.
Yeah, I think that's possibly true. I do know that you would have a lot of variability if you had complete independence of every faculty in the grading student assessments. Like you might get much more variability in our own model to know whether as a student really have they demonstrate proficiency and has every student demonstrate it. But in this case, what's the ratios of students to course instructors and program mentors, those ratios are the ones that ultimately we pay the closest attention to, because that really is ensuring that the volume of students are, every single one of them feels like the whole of WGU is designed for them, because they get a very personalized faculty engagement in the teaching and learning experience. The evaluation faculty, that's where we leverage part-time faculty much more than anywhere else. Actually, it's the only category where we have part-time faculty, just to be clear. All the other faculty are full-time faculty. And so in that case, you know, you need the subject matter experts to do all the evaluation. And so we train them on our assessments. You know, they bring the subject matter expertise, but we have a very large volume of faculty who are likely, you know, full-time faculty at other institutions.
So Steve, you've taught for years and years and years, and I teach on and off as I'm in the mood to do it, since it's not my
Me
job
too.
To teach.
35 years I've been in the mood.
I teach class once a semester, once a year, something. But I would bet that most faculty would be thrilled to have someone else do the grading. That seems to be perhaps the least enjoyable part.
I think they would be thrilled with the actual entry. Whether or not all faculty would be thrilled to have a third party evaluate
their students
at the end, that would be I don't mean this in any way to be difficult. That would be a different model.
Yeah.
That would be frightening, I think, for some. I think it's terrific, but then I teach in a program that goes toward that very thing. Our adjuncts all come from industry, and you know, that's the program I'm currently working in, we sort of already have that. But you're right, that part of it is very interesting to me. And President Pulsifer, you had suggested that this helps maintain the integrity of the entire process. What do you do to make sure that all the other steps along the way have integrity in place? And what I mean by that is, I teach in an online program. That's my current teaching assignment, along with assisting President Wyatt. And we worry about, you know, is it actually the student that is taking the exams. How do you maintain that type of integrity in a massively online environment of the type you have?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think one of the things is that first and foremost, the entire journey of our students is powered by technology. So their student identity with us is known from the day that they're actually a prospect all the way till they're alumni. And all of their engagement with us as an institution, whether it's with their faculty, whether it's with financial aid, whether it's with enrollment and enrollment counselors, whether it's with student support and technology services, like all of those is powered by really all of their individual engagement with the learning resources and our portals and the assessments and pre-assessment. Like everything about what a student is doing and how they're engaging is understood such that, you know, the individuals themselves are building a profile of learning. Now, when it comes down to very specifically the type of thing you raise, is we've actually found and designed for a very effective proctoring ability to where 99.5% of all of our assessments are proctored virtually. That the combination of really well-designed technology that allows for video monitoring, keyboard monitoring, all the computer monitoring, et cetera, that you actually have much greater reliability in our proctoring model than you'd ever have in a physical location.
Right.
Now, part of that has also been some of the things around how we don't allow reliance only on your laptop's camera. We also actually utilize a secondary camera. All the identification and all the, you know, the facial recognition combined with ID, keystroke patterns, like you name it, like the it allows a proctor to monitor behaviors during assessment in a much more comprehensive way than a proctor walking the rows in a testing center or a proctoring location does, such that our reliability around that is significantly better than what you would get through a traditional context.
Can I ask, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I said that's vitally important. The virtual context, there are ways, the combination of software plus proctoring plus, you know, faculty engagement, that there are a lot of you know, biometrics, if you will, in a way that you have greater reliance that the student is the one doing the work than you would in some more traditional classroom-based setting.
I just know that this is one of the concerns that faculty who are looking to move online or universities that are looking to greatly expand their online presence sometimes run into, which is concerns amongst faculty, particularly faculty maybe of a certain age group or who are perhaps less aware of the technology that's available. They're concerned about, as you suggest, proctoring exams and other things, but you're actually having a higher percentage of guaranteeing that it's that's the actual student's work than we are.
The amount of fraud is very, very low, simply because there's a lot. It's a lot more difficult to actually circumvent the controls that are in place in a virtual context than it is in a physical context. And but that being said, it is like they should be rightfully concerned. Meaning, as you consider investing in distance education models or online models, you know, these are things that WGU had to figure out 15 years ago. You know. But we figured out and scaled them. But if you are where we were 15 years ago, hey, these are all questions that one should be addressing, and then figure out what the right solution is and how do you make sure that you address that. And because we've surely had to do that. What I do know is this, though, too, which is that, you know, it's what, 7 million of 20 million adults in higher ed today are taking all or some of their program online. That number is growing at some 7 or 10% a year. Where those in a purely on-premise situation is declining at the same rate effectively. So it is a reality of virtually all learning environments of the future that the online virtual model is going to be a factor, even if it's in a blended context, meaning both in-class and online learning model. But I can see that in the computer science exams that exist today in most institutions. So much of the work and the tests and the labs and everything else are done online, not in a proctored environment, and you have to validate, you have to have all the checks and controls in place to ensure that there's validation or that this is in fact the student doing the work. And then that can be done that can be done equally well online as it can be on premise. And in most cases, we found with the technology and tools available today, it's more reliable in a virtual context than it is in a physical context.
So can I fast forward for about 20 years or so? What
from now?
Yeah, what do you you just described the changing dynamics of online versus face-to-face and the growth that WGU has seen over the last 21 years and other schools that have had some changes. What do you think the landscape's going to look like in 20, 25 years?
Well, I do think there are a couple easy things that are, to me, almost matter of fact now. It's not a question of whether, it's just a question of how quickly. And so two of those, I would say, first and foremost, that the majority of the adults in higher education in 20 years from now, in fact, I think the significant majority of the adults will be over the age of 24. And so that is the students being served are of a different type than the stereotype that exists today of higher ed, meaning it's your 18 to 22 year olds, they're residence based, you know, they're full time, they're not doing anything else. I think that is not going to be a reality. I think already today, most of the evidence suggests that the profile of our students, not even in 20 years, but in 10 years, is that the majority of them are going to be over 24. They're going to be working full time. They're going to have children. They're going to be independent financially from their parents. And that's going to be a reality, and such that their needs are very different than how many institutions have designed for. They designed for the kind of first time, full time student model. The second thing I think is a reality is that the majority of students will actually be taking or will be accessing education online. And so it will present challenges to many of the, you know, small or regional, you know, kind of localized service institutions that will have difficulty, you know, with their relevancy to the population of students that they serve today, because so many online institutions can provide access to really high quality education, but do so without a physical location. And the internet is definitely making it possible to access and learn independent of time and place. I think there's going to be a couple other interesting things I would highlight. One is I do think we'll see the unbundling of the, you know, bachelor's credential. I think we'll see a significant advancement of micro-credentials will create more of the stackable model that's often talked about. I highlighted this, Steve, at the Northwest Commission.
Right.
That those competency-based credentials versus a bachelor's rank, the competency credentials are going to be very relevant and increasingly relevant as adults not only need to gain their first set of skills to get opportunity, but they need to continually be reskilled and upskilled. And those competency credentials need to be transferable and stackable into degree ranks, because those will remain important, but you'll see a rapid scaling of some of these micro credentials. The last thing I would probably highlight is that there will be an emergence of learning or, you know, post-secondary education providers that will test the boundaries of the current institutions, the accreditors that oversee them, regulators that oversee them. Like the learning that we as adults are accessing to maintain readiness for the experience that we're trying to, you know, pursue and opportunities and the credential or competencies that are needed in those, we're going to see a proliferation of alternative post-secondary education providers, and that will test the bounds of the role of the institution. It will also test the bounds of the creditor, the regulators and others, because that learning still needs to be portable and transferable and validated in some way, that most of that validation exists within an accredited higher ed institution today. And that, I think, within 20 years will surely get disrupted.
Today, most of the education is occurring in a Carnegie kind of seat time-based model. Do you think that competency-based education is going to take over the majority of the higher ed world?
I don't think I'm as I think it's going to be competency-based education will surely continue to increase in its importance and relevancy in terms of the educational models and approaches that are needed for access and high quality and great student success and outcomes. Do I think it's going to be the predominant model, like online is going to be, or adult learners as a population? Probably not. I think a lot of the course-based models are still going to be relevant, but I do think the notion of cracking the credit hour is something that is a disruption that's already happened, and it's an imperfect model for where post-secondary education is going, and competency-based is much more effective. You know, I think students by themselves already in traditional credit hour models are disrupting it, meaning they're not going to the classes, they're just waiting until the end of the term to take the final. You're like, how about you just give me that final first, and I'll then go enroll in the course that I need to take so that I can, finish. So I think that competency-based approach, it will continue to advance. I think it is a great means by which you can serve larger populations of adults today that are not being served. Is it going to be the majority? I don't think so. Will it increase the share? Surely.
I can remember 20 years ago hearing Mike Leavitt, Governor Leavitt at the time, saying, who cares how much time you spend in a seat? We care about what you're learning.
I do agree with that. But
those weren't his words, but that's the message he was saying.
Well, I think that it does fly in the face of Malcolm Gladwell kind of outliers. What if you spend 10,000 hours doing? Like, what if it doesn't require me to do 10,000 hours to be competent or highly competent in a particular area? It's like, the measurement of time is actually one measure, but definitely not the only measure. And I think we are quite comfortable with the fact that there are multiple measures of learning, and time is only one of them, and an imperfect one at that. So.
Yeah, we have a saying that we occasionally use, which is experience doesn't lead to learning. It's reflecting on that experience that leads to learning. Mm-hmm. Because a person can grow old and not learn anything. It's thinking through the experience.
And I can prove it.
Yeah. It's the thoughtful reflection on experience that leads to meaningful learning.
With my relatively short tenure in higher education, I am very passionate about it. And we do know that as institutions like Southern Utah University, like WGU and so many others, that we are all trying to expand access to high quality education with great outcomes. And that's going to require continued innovation in all sorts of things, pedagogical models, delivery models, assessment models, even alternative providers and credentials. Like, those are going to be key to ensuring that education advances with it. Now, as Steve, you saw, at the cusp of the fourth industrial revolution and the age of intelligence or information, we do know that the shelf life of competency is shortening,
right,
and thus the acceleration of learning needs to be realized. And I think great institutions will be at the forefront of that innovation.
This has been a delight to visit with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Steve.
You've been listening to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast featuring Scott Wyatt, the president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. Our guest via telephone today has been Scott Pulsifer, the president of Western Governors University, and our discussion has been delightful. We hope that you've enjoyed it as well. We look forward to seeing you again soon. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Solutions for Higher Education. To subscribe to this podcast, please visit www.suu.edu/presidentspodcast, where you will find both the audio and a written transcript of today's podcast. The original music for this podcast was composed by Jack Barton, a master's degree student in music technology at SUU. For more information about Southern Utah University, please visit www.suu.edu.